The U.S. was never going to have the political will to outlast the Taliban, because sooner or later the U.S. was going to leave, and they aren't going anywhere. The public has no appetite for escalation, and a large majority of Americans wants U.S. troops out. Support for withdrawal is strongest among veterans and their families, who have borne the burden of this war and have the largest stake in it. Ignoring majority opinion to continue an unwinnable war is a perfect example of the lack of democratic accountability in the U.S. foreign policy. Biden has an opportunity to put himself on the right side of public opinion and to do what is in the best interest of the country. But he must be willing to ignore the carping from foreign policy establishment figures and hawkish pundits. U.S. political and military leaders are allergic to admitting failure, no matter how overwhelming the evidence of that failure may be. An entire generation of politicians and officers has been involved in selling the war with misleading and false claims of progress. The perverse incentives of U.S. political culture have made perpetuating failed policies much easier and more rewarding than ending them. This is how withdrawing from a lost war has become more politically risky than prolonging the conflict. The persistence of the non-essential safe haven myth has meant that many Americans imagine that the war in Afghanistan still has something to do with preventing terrorism on U.S. soil 2 decades after the original attacks, but it does not. Keeping troops deployed in war zones is not a safeguard against terrorism. If anything, maintaining a military presence in countries where American forces are not wanted is more likely to provoke more attacks in the future. Regardless, the reality is that the U.S. is exceptionally secure from physical threats, and terrorism is a relatively minor threat that does not require them to wage decades-long wars. Withdrawing from Afghanistan should force U.S. political leaders and analysts to recognize that the larger so-called war on terror has also been a costly waste. U.S. heavily militarized response to terrorism has served only to cause more death and destruction across two continents. It is time to end the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and then U.S. government needs to shut down the rest of the endless wars that it has been fighting since 2001.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the significance of charity. Brothers and sisters, we know that human society is not in the ideal form and shape wherever we live. We know that there are too many destitute people, there are too many homeless people, there are too many hungry people, there are too many thirsty people, there are too many people dying of diseases and don't have medicines. This is all physical. Now come to the spiritual and mental side of things. This world is a complete wreck. And we all realize this. Look at people's ideological development and nourishment. They are starving to death, or maybe many have already died. What are we doing to make sure that people, not only just physically, but also in terms of their spirituality and in terms of their ideology, they are following the right path and moving towards salvation? Well, this is where charity comes into the play. And we're not, when we talk about charity, you know, somehow we just get focused on money part of it. Well, that's there, but there's a charity of ilm, of knowledge, and that is to preach others, to teach others. So don't think like when we talk about charity that it's only the, you know, dollars or tomans or, you know, euros or pounds. No, its scope is way broader, and those things are included in there too. Now, what is the significance of charity real quick? Well, number one, it's a shade on the day of judgment. The prophet said, the believer's shade on the day of resurrection will be this charity. On the day when all other shade will be gone, Allah will shade and shelter those who give charity and care for the poor and the needy. The Muslim's sacrifice in this life will be their protection on the day of judgment. Another significance is a protection from calamity. By sacrificing part of one's wealth and giving it in charity, the individual is guaranteeing protection for themselves from tragedy and misfortune. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the significance of charity. So we said, you know, it's giving charity in the way of Allah is a shade on the day of judgment. And then we said it's a protection from calamity. Now the third one is, it's better to give than to take. It is considered better to give charity than receive it. One should be wary of repeatedly soliciting and taking from sadaqah and zakat funds. Those who refrain from taking these funds so that more will be left for the other needy will be provided for by Allah and be made self-reliant by Allah. Last but not the least, relieving a person in debt is also a form of charity. The Prophet said, if anyone would like Allah to save him from the hardships of the day of resurrection, he should give more time to his debtor who is short of money, or remit his debt altogether. Brothers and sisters, if someone owes you money, it is considered charity if you show mercy, give the debtor more time to pay back his loan, or even cancel out the person's debt. If charity is a person's shade on the day of judgment, canceling a person's debt will also serve as a protection. So remember, charity is not just giving out money. Charity, it applies, it's a concept of Islam that applies on different dimensions and aspects of our lives. If you have knowledge, spread knowledge. If you have any other skill, give that skill in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. All of that is considered to be charity. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. hypocrisy to come will be even greater than anything tried by the Trump administration, says Patrick Lawrence, writer, in an article published under the heading Biden's Inhumanity on Syria. Stay tuned for the details, please. For a time after Joe Biden took office, not quite 3 months ago, among the questions raised was how the new administration would address the Syrian question. It is early days yet, but one now detects the Biden administration's Syria policy in faint outline. From what one can make out, it is bleak, it is vicious, it is unconscionably cruel to the Syrian people. And it may prove yet worse than anything the Trump administration came up with. Will Biden's national security people drop the covert coup Operation Barack Obama set it in motion 9 years ago? Is failure long evident? Or will they reinvigorate American support for savage terrorists in the name of regime changing the government in Damascus? What about the American troops still operating illegally on Syrian soil? What about the oil fields the Trump administration took to protecting from the nation that owns them? What about the brazen theft of crude from those fields? And what, of course, about the murderous sanctions that various executive orders have escalated on numerous occasions since the second Bush administration imposed the first of them 17 long years ago? What will Biden and his people do, in short, about the mess the U.S. has made of the Syrian Arab Republic? These were the questions. Answers now begin to arrive. As a long record shows, the Zionist regime of Israel wants to destabilize Syria as long as it is not governed by a pliant Western client. It continues to bomb Syrian targets, including Damascus, on a regular basis. With these realities in view, we can confidently surmise that the Biden administration does not actually have a Syria policy. Apartheid regime of Israel has a Syria policy it dictates to the Zionist Biden administration. Antony Blinken tweeted last week, "How could we not take action to help them? Our common humanity demands it. Shame on us if we don't." One already grows accustomed to new Secretary of State's widely disconnected remarks on social media and elsewhere. This guy has a troubled relationship with reality. We must begin to conclude. As the Gray Zone's Max Blumenthal replied to this morbid hypocrisy, if you treated your children like you treat the Syrian people, you would be jailed for child abuse. But let us set aside their preposterous assertion that while starving Syrians of bread, fuel, medicines, and reconstruction funding other nations would otherwise provide, Blinken thinks of suffering Syrians as he does his children. And why would Blinken broadcast these things on social media at this moment? Why would he summon common humanity when there is no shred of evidence that he or anyone else among Biden's national security crew gives a tinker's damn about those human beings commonly known as Syrians? The Biden administration appears to be preparing Americans for a round of Washington's morally bankrupt, grossly illegal campaign to bring down the government of a sovereign nation because it does not conform to America's imperial diktat, and because, as noted, this will please the Israelis. Liberal and progressive conscience must be eased, and among others, a state of slumber must be maintained. 2. Blinken has, in all likelihood, begun the work of keeping Washington's coalition partners, notably the French and the British, in the Syrian subversion game by providing cover for the savagery that is to come. Reading straight from the Vietnam-era script, Blinken wants America's allies and partners, a favorite phrase of his, to be confident that when they bomb Syrian children, the world will understand it is in order to save them. Reading into these matters, texts and subtexts, we can begin to brace ourselves for what is probably on the way in Syria. American troops will remain on the ground almost certainly to increase in number over time. The U.S., in concert with the same fantasies it has to date bankrolled, trained and supplied, will continue to sequester Syria's oil fields and the fertile wheat fields that ought to be feeding the population. The hypocrisy to come will be yet greater than anything the Trump administration tried on. Here comes the bankruptcy of the responsibility to protect at its very worst. This will be liberal righteousness with a genteel veneer. One would think the policy cliques in Washington would learn something once in a while, but no. They cannot learn because they cannot quite get to thinking. This column concerns early signs of another foreign policy disaster that may be impending. Should these signs prove out, we will watch as an empire already on its back foot makes another desperate attempt to defend its fading hegemony. Let us once again bitterly hope for failure. America could knock over whoever it wished long ago, and it could send men to the moon. No longer does it seem able to do either.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah.
by the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, other life forms. You're listening to Youth Station, only from IRIB English Radio. I am your humble and excited host, Zainab.
You seem to be too excited, sister. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. I'm Hassanain.
Assalamu alaikum, bro. How you doing?
I'm good, alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. Right, technology. The wonderful world of technology is what I'm going to be talking to you about today.
That seems to be interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. It really is. My question regarding technology is whether or not it has helped us in our worship.
Yes, of course. Definitely it has helped in our worship, you know, especially in this time of pandemic, you know, where we cannot go, like everyone, you know, where there's lockdown, everyone cannot go to their centers, they cannot go to their mosques. So especially in the month of Ramadan, or be it Muharram, you know, we can do our majalis online. And but still, you know, this tabligh, the word is of Islam, you know, it keeps spreading. So with the help of these social media, like be it Instagram or anything, YouTube, so we can still spread the word of Islam, you know, although we cannot, you know, gather together. So you're sitting here and you're doing tabligh, you're preaching the people who are living that side of the world. So of course it has helped in many ways.
But do you think that, I mean, when you put, with everything there are pros and cons, right? And technology is no exception.
Yeah, like every coin has two sides.
Exactly. Every coin has two sides. So when we put the pros and cons of technology onto the two sides of a scale, which one do you think outweighs the other? The pros of technology could be the fact that, especially now during a pandemic, not everything is accessible anymore. We can't gather in centers and mosques and majalis like we used to. But now it's like our scholars are a click of a finger away,
right?
And sure, it doesn't have that sense of congregation in Jama'ah anymore, but the knowledge factor and the benefit factor is still there, which makes it really, really good. This could be the pros of of technology. Or even like, if pandemic aside, you know, everything is just so compact now. Like I remember before smartphones came and we wanted to go to Haram or something, we'd have to take like a thick Quran and a thick mafatih and a tasbih and a turba and all that. I'll put all that stuff into our bags and it's heavy and this and that. But now you just take your cell phone with you and you're good.
Yeah, I've got everything in there. You know, everything in that.
Even if you don't have the applications, you can just punch it in the internet and you can have it online. You can listen to it and this and that. And it's wonderful. So these could be the pros for technology. But then when you compare it to the cons, because I feel technology distracts us from spirituality and worship just as much as it could facilitate.
Of course, that's right. Because, okay, so when you're reading, for example, let's say that you're reading the Quran. So you're complete, your focus is on the ayats of the divine words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
So you're reading that, you're understanding that, that's really good. I'm talking about the normal Quran.
For example, the book.
If you're reading it on your mobile, so then there's suddenly the ting, there's notification. Oh, who's that? Someone sent me a message. Oh, that might be my boss's message. I have to see that. That's more important.
Yeah.
I won't get my salary. So, you know, these are the distractions. Your friend might have messaged you.
Something funny.
Yeah.
A meme about a cat getting
stabbed. So, you know, that focus that you had, you know, while reading the Quran, that spirituality, you get out of that. So that's the con and the many different cons.
Well, here's the thing, though. You could always put your phone on flight mode when you want to recite Quran on it.
It's good if you do that.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a will, there's a way. There's a solution to everything. And I think one of the greatest things about technology is that it's become so versatile, so flexible, and it accommodates to almost every need of yours. I think it's turned into such a strong, great, reliable companion for us all that so, you reach a point where like, why do I even need a wife, you know?
So the other reason might be, the technology might not have, major cons, but, the reading from the hard copy, the book itself might have more, it might be more beneficial. Mm. So, my teacher always used to say that when you're reading any book or a hadith or anything, so just read it from the book. So I asked him, like, how does it make any difference? Like, I read it from my phone or the book. He's like, when you read it from the book, so, you just keep, you just go through it. Mm. Like, you read one hadith, you're like, oh, there's one more hadith. What's that saying? You just keep turning the pages. That way you get more knowledge and you read more. Right. So you start comparing the hadith.
Right, right.
So in the phone, like, if you wanted to read one hadith, you just read that and then... done, that's finished.
Yeah.
But when you have the book with you, you just keep turning the pages and you read more.
Another aspect about the technology and the smart books that we have that kind of scares me, though even that itself is developing, is the effects it has on our eyes and on our minds and how those waves are affecting our brain development and our brain cells, because it's a proven fact. Unless you have you put on certain glasses that filter the blue lights, or you have a certain screen that is best fit for the human eye,
at least sitting
at the laptop and looking at your cell phone for too long really gives you a headache.
Yeah, but still, you're not looking at the bigger picture. You know, the bigger pro of this, of this technology is, when you're reading, when you're in your center, in any majalis or any speech, there's any sheikh who's giving speech. So you go to the mosque, you go to the center.
Yeah.
So only you're using by it. Mm. Okay, so it's only the 100 people in the center. They're getting benefited by the speech of the sheikh.
Yeah.
But when it's online, it's for the whole world. When the sheikh is speaking online, he puts his video, he uploads his video on the social media. So, it's open to all, be Muslim or non-Muslim.
Mm.
The word of Islam is spread this way.
Mm.
And also it's spread to many people.
Which makes it even more sensitive. I mean, now that it's the age of technology and information and everything is more accessible for everyone. There's more exposure, basically.
Isn't that good?
It's good, but it's risky. I mean, it's sensitive now. We have to be more careful.
The thing itself is good. The word, as you said, it has got more exposure. So the word of Islam, it's good that everyone gets to know about it.
Mm.
But the problem arises, when the speaker...
It's not done properly.
Accent. Yeah, that's when the problem arises.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean about it being now... I mean... We're living in more sensitive times as we are in living in the time of technology and information and yada, yada, yada. One wrong move, one wrong word. And
online, that's one of the cons, I might say. Online, it's just the delivery.
Mm.
You just deliver a speech.
Mm.
But also, it can also be, there might also be an engagement, when the sheikh, he delivers a speech, if people, they don't understand, if they have got any doubts about it, so they can ask the questions to the sheikh, then he can clear the matter. So, but the problem is, if the person itself, he misportrays anything about Islam, any concept of Islam, so many people,
will be manipulated. Exactly.
Yeah.
They'll be misguided, and it will create a false face for Islam, and it will create more complications and whatnot. So we have to be extra careful with our choice of words, with the way we represent ourselves in our religion, because now we're on a bigger platform and there's more exposure in the entire world. We say one thing regarding a certain matter, that sentence could be taken out of context.
Yeah. Okay, so according to me, what I feel is, one of the biggest cons of this, technology or this online, tabligh or anything, whatever you may call it, one of the biggest cons is, you know, people discussing between the Shias or between the Muslim community, people discussing the controversial matters on the media. So you're like, you're discussing, okay, so it's like, you know, one scholar, he disagrees with the other, so he takes that matter online. Bro, what are you doing? You're just creating disunity among the people. You know, you fighting with your own brother from your same community, then what should other people think?
Exactly.
Look at them, they fight between themselves. So, you know, discussing like controversial matters and, you know, getting controversial things online, like you have a disagreement with anyone, beat anyone. You get that matter online, like, he says that, I don't agree with him. You know, this is all about, you know, you're creating disunity among the people. You know, this group, I don't believe them. I don't believe in them. I don't like them. They have so-and-so beliefs. So this spoils the image of Islam.
Absolutely.
You know, if also, unfortunately, between the Shias, if they're discussing about these matters, it spoils the image of Ahl al-Tashay. So the people from that side are like, ah, look at them. They fight between themselves, bro.
Exactly. How can you possibly want to have unity among the ummah as a whole if you guys can't even maintain Shi'i unity, right? That's another problem, and I think it comes down to the fact that there's more exposure now that we have a bigger platform, and we need to be there's no reason for us to be doing our dirty laundry out in public like that, right?
Yeah, so I personally believe that these matters shouldn't be online. It shouldn't be done online.
And yeah, if you have any feud or any beef among yourselves, sort it out in private. There's no need to put it up on your social media for the rest of the world to know about it. That could be one of the dangers of technology and social media. But on the other hand, there's a lot of benefits. It's like a two-edged sword.
Right.
And it depends on how we utilize it, how we choose to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
And like all other things, it's totally up to us. You know, a person, I remember when social media first came, a lot of the scholars were debating whether such a tool should even be halal. Because
nowadays you see that the rehbar, you know, he encourages the youth, the people,
the
to use social media.
Yeah. In the proper way.
Yeah, in the proper way. Yeah, the social media is the best thing if you use it in the proper way.
Exactly, because it's inevitable. It already happened, right? It already took the world by storm, and now our lives are absolutely dependent on it. You know, we'd be crippled, especially now that we're living in a pandemic, we'd be crippled if we couldn't use technology to help take forward a lot of our endeavors. But again, it needs to be used in the right way.
Yeah, if it's used in the right way, it's the best thing. Because, you know, a non-Muslim, he will never go to your center, he'll never come to your mosque or any holy places.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't even read any hadith or Quran. So when you put any hadith of imams online, so that's what Ahl al-Bayt always say. So spread our word. So that's how the word is spread. You can translate any hadith from the Arabic language to English, and you can post it so that everybody can read it.
Benefit from it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Everybody can read
as
it.
As long
and
as it's done right.
Yeah.
That's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. However, thank you so very much to our listeners for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are. That everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free and made me strong.
Limelight.
In a little over a year since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the UK government has issued 70 coronavirus regulations with little if any oversight by Parliament. The state has introduced new laws that are far more draconian than anything required by health emergency. The laws have, for example, made all protests during the COVID surge unlawful, even where protesters have been socially distanced and those participating have worn masks. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Renton, author. This article is published under the heading, Trumpism is not just an American problem, it's festering in UK. Stay tuned for the details, please. In the UK, Trumpism has continued to gain momentum. Under the leadership of Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party, the UK government has taken a distinct authoritarian turn, using the pandemic as a cover for introducing laws and regulations to criminalize protests and facilitating police repression against communities of color. At the center of the left complaints about growing state power is the new police, crime, sentencing and courts bill. It is intended to map out the relationship between police and protesters in the new post-COVID world. The bill would extend police powers to ban protests. If it is passed, a protest could be banned if a senior police officer believes that the event would have a serious disruption to the activities of an organization. Any effective protest would be potentially unlawful. In a little over a year since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the UK government has issued 70 coronavirus regulations, with little if any oversight by Parliament. The state has introduced new laws that are far more draconian than anything required by health emergency. The laws have, for example, made all protests during the COVID surge unlawful, even where protesters have been socially distanced and those participating have worn masks. The laws also have been unevenly applied. In the first 9 months of the lockdown, police in England and Wales have issued 32,000 fixed penalty notices for breach of the COVID lockdown rules. Young black and Asian men have been twice as likely to be fined as their white counterparts. The moment at which most people became conscious of all these laws occurred last month, after 33-year-old Sarah Everard disappeared from her South London home. A serving police officer was arrested and charged with her kidnapping and murder. A crowd of several hundred people gathered for a vigil to express solidarity with Everard. They were attacked by police officers who stormed the park's bandstand, trampled on the flowers left by well-wishers, and made numerous arrests. Conservative Home Secretary Priti Patel first authorized the police attack and then sought to distance herself from it. This is not the only instance of the COVID rules being used to punish social justice causes and to forgive those close to the governing regime. When Dominic Cummings, the chief advisor to government, was caught driving around the UK 200 miles from his home in open breach of the COVID rules, Johnson insisted that his advisor had acted responsibly, legally, and with integrity. When the Prime Minister himself was caught outside his permitted local travel area, ministers defended him, saying that the word local in the rules didn't mean local after all. After a year in which the left has been largely absent from the public eye, protests have begun again, warning not merely against the bill, but authoritarianism which underpins it. The UK's authoritarian turn was strongly fueled and shaped by the rise of Trumpism in the US. Trump always recognized an affinity between his project and his imitators in the UK. After the British voted to leave the European Union in June 2016, Trump claimed that the result proved his own politics could win. Trump said that he stood for Brexit plus plus plus. Trump told a rally of his supporters they voted to reclaim control over immigration, over their economy, over their government, and predicted that U.S. voters would do the same. After the rally, Trump tweeted they would soon be calling me Mr. Brexit. It took another 3 years for the UK's Conservative Party to choose a leader capable of ruling along Trumpian lines. However, since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister in summer 2019, UK politics has lurched to the right. Just as Trump governed not through Congress but through executive orders in the US, we have also seen an unprecedented expansion of secondary legislation in the UK. Laws made by the executive rather than the legislature. Their expansion reaches towards the limits of what ministers are allowed to do under Britain's unwritten constitution. The justification for this shift to executive government has been the same in the UK as it was in the US Recall Executive Order 1367-9, under which President Trump banned immigration to the U.S. from seven predominantly Muslim countries back in January 2017. One justification given for that change was that, under the U.S. Constitution, the president has absolute power over foreign affairs and national security. He could do whatever he liked. In Britain, the equivalent measure was an attempt in summer 2019 to prorogue Parliament, in other words, to prevent legislature from sitting, for fear that it would pass laws preventing Johnson from crashing out of the European Union without an exit treaty. Just as in the US, those defending this move argued that the government was free to do what it liked, that Johnson and not Parliament was sovereign when it came to foreign affairs. The UK Supreme Court found that the attempt to prorogue Parliament had been unlawful. The move was, however, the first step in an ongoing battle. In the UK, as in the US, the government is trying to rewrite history. The US saw Trump's 1776 commission, which tried to sanitize the role of the so-called founding fathers in upholding slavery. In Britain, the British have had a commission on race and ethnic disparities, which argued that the slave period was not only about profit and suffering, but how culturally African people transformed themselves into a remodeled African Britain.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The significance of the presidency as the heaviest managerial responsibility of the country.
The second issue is about the significance of the presidency. The presidency is a very important issue. The most important and influential managerial responsibility is the presidency. Now, some people claim that the president has no authority, that he is a mere caterer, and that he has just 12-15% authority. I do not know how they calculate these things. It is several years now that they have been saying these things here and there, but all of them are untrue. These statements are made either out of lack of responsibility or out of ignorance, or God forbid, with ulterior motives. This is not the case. The presidency is one of the heaviest and most demanding responsibilities. To be exact, it is not one of the heaviest, rather it is the heaviest managerial responsibility in the country. Almost all managerial centers of the country are at the disposal of the president. The judiciary branch and military organizations have certain managerial responsibilities as well, but compared to the ones in the executive branch, their managerial responsibilities amount to a few percent above zero.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith. To be stronger among
Almost all managerial responsibilities. Thousands of responsibilities are at the disposal of the head of the executive branch. The entire ratified budget of the country is at the disposal of the president. This is because the head of the planning and budget organization of the country is a vice president, and therefore it is directly supervised by the presidency. The same is true of the country's governmental resources. Most of such resources are at the disposal of the president. Therefore, the other managerial responsibilities at the periphery of the executive branch are really insignificant. The presidency has such an important status. Now, you want to elect a president? Therefore, notice what important responsibility falls on us voters. Of course, my vote is as significant as the vote of a 17-18-year-old boy. It is neither more nor less important than his. We want to go and choose a president, and therefore, we should know what an important responsibility falls on the president. This is another important point.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
around the world with reporters.
The Islamic Jihad movement and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine held a sit-in in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The event took place near the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing in northern Gaza. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights. The Israeli regime has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons.
The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine came together today to express solidarity with the prisoners who are languishing in Israeli jails. The conditions of prisoners are only getting worse as days go by under the watchful eye of the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are subjected to degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits. Palestinians say that Arab countries normalizing relations with the Israeli regime are encouraging Tel Aviv to violate the rights of Palestinians.
The normalization by Arab regimes has badly affected the conditions of Palestinian prisoners. Normalization of ties with the Zionists is a betrayal of Palestine and the Palestinian prisoners. All Arabs must understand that the United States and Israel are the enemies of the Arab and Muslim nations.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and the symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, vowed to use all forms of resistance to free Palestinian prisoners.
The so-called peace deals will not free Palestinian prisoners. Only resistance can free Palestinian prisoners from Zionist jails. Capturing more Israeli soldiers to exchange them with Palestinian prisoners must be a top priority for all Palestinian resistance groups.
Statistics show that over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967 due to medical negligence. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Israel is currently holding some 5,000 Palestinians behind bars, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says two of its drones hit Jizan Airport and King Khalid Air Base, both in southwestern Saudi Arabia. The army says this is part of intensified attacks to retaliate Riyadh's ongoing war on Yemen.
We are entitled to carry out the attacks as part of our normal and legitimate right to respond to the escalation of Saudi Arabia and its comprehensive blockade on our country, and we promise the Saudi regime more painful operations as long as the aggression and siege continues.
His comments come as over the past months, Saudi Arabia has either roundly denied any Yemeni attacks inside the country or claimed Yemeni missiles and drones were intercepted before making impact.
The Saudi regime realizes that it may lose face if people of the country come to know about the Yemeni attacks. The Saudi regime is controlling its people by force, and it is afraid of an internal revolution against the ruling regime. So, this is why Riyadh continues to avoid talking about the Yemeni attacks.
Military experts say the Yemeni army is well capable of expanding its attacks to a wider range of targets to make them more painful for Riyadh. They say this could inflict greater damage to Saudi Arabia economically and militarily.
Saudi Arabia must realize that the painful phase is yet to come. Saudi Arabia will lose its economic power and military capabilities in this phase. Saudi Arabia says its army is the sixth most powerful army in the world, but 6 years of war on Yemen have proven that the Saudi army is extremely weak and has achieved nothing, while the Yemeni military capabilities have increased. And I believe that the continuation of this war is further damaging to the kingdom.
The Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is a response to the deadly Saudi-led aggression and siege that caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of them women and children.
Saudi Arabia has been calling for peace talks with Yemeni forces to stop their attacks while refusing to grant the demand to end the siege and siege on Yemen. This leaves the Yemeni army no option but to step up its retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul. The visit comes amid tensions between Kiev and Moscow over Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, Russia bulked up its military presence on Ukraine's eastern border, threatening military action. During the meeting, the two presidents spoke about ways of cooperation in different sectors and strengthening ties between the two countries, including free trade, tourism, and sports. Following the meeting, which was also attended by ministers from both sides, a number of agreements were signed.
Turkey strongly defends the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. We hope that the escalation in eastern Ukraine will come to an end and the conflict will be resolved through dialogue based on the Minsk agreement.
The United States, after informing Turkey as per the Montreux Convention, sent two warships through Turkish straits towards the Black Sea. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the warships will stay in the Black Sea until May 4.
The tension between Russia and Ukraine is increasing every minute. Ukraine is waiting for support from the EU and the US. But Russia has clearly expressed that Crimea is its red line and will not give it to Ukraine. I think this visit is aimed at sorting things out. Ukraine wants to make sure that Turkey is on its side, especially after the phone call between Turkish and Russian presidents.
Late on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed with his Turkish counterpart over the phone the Ukraine crisis and the presence of U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Turkish president assured that Ankara's cooperation with Ukraine does not mean it is against Russia. Analysts believe Turkey is trying to play the role of peacemaker in the region without taking sides. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was an utter shock for the destitute Rohingya community in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather, it gives government more freedom to act swiftly. Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of